You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 102.7 FM.
The epic Chinese film City of Life and Death is a historical account of the Siege of Nanjing. Originally filmed in 2009, the film is only now playing in Vancouver. It's showing tonight and all next week at the Vancouver International Film Center on Seymour. And Martha and Marty Roth saw the film, and they've joined me in the studio to share their thoughts. Welcome again back to Red Eye.
Thanks,
Well, thank you, Mordecai.
Nice to be here.
When did the Siege of Nanjing take place?
The siege began in 1937, before Europe had entered the war. The city was occupied in November of that year, and the population was massacred and raped during the ensuing months. We don't know about it so much because we're Westerners. We have a Western bias. In fact, in recent years, the cinematic showing of war and atrocity has concentrated on the stories of the death camps, the resistance, and the complicity of others, including the Allies. And that seems to have drunk up all the available space for World War II. I mean, we sometimes felt as though there were no other stories from the 20th century's major war. But with City of Life and Death, Chinese director Liu Juan has taken a giant step toward balancing this skewed representation.
This is Liu's third feature film, and it's won many awards.
And how did he research the background for this film?
Well, he spent 2 years working on the testimony of witnesses to the event.
Yeah, the film opens with a dedication to the 300,000 victims of the Nanjing Massacre. Of course, in those days it was called Nanking, at least in the West. That's followed in the film by a sequence of postcards, all written in English, presumably by Westerners living in China, telling people back in the West about the progress of the war in Asia.
It's a massive slaughter. How does the director communicate the magnitude of this?
Well, the narrative begins with the demolition of the city walls, and we then follow a squad of Japanese soldiers into the city. They're anxiously looking for their enemies, and they walk into a hornet's nest of Chinese resistance. A short battle ensues, reinforcements arrive, and the small body of Chinese fighters are annihilated. After this, there is only the rounding up of groups of Chinese, male and female, and varieties of slaughter. Evidence of the massacre is seen everywhere as the camera moves through the ruined city, bodies lying on the ground, hanging from poles, heads swaying from overhead ropes.
I can't remember a film that brings home so clearly the chaos of war. Maybe Bondarchuk's Russian language War and Peace comes close. And yet, with this vivid sense of chaos, director Liu somehow has his camera find individuals. The camera pans across hundreds of actors and extras in vast spaces, fighting, milling, waiting, retreating, or lying dead, and still the camera eye shows us individuals and not a faceless mass. It's an amazing achievement.
Marty, the way you describe some of the scenes, it sounds a very difficult film to watch.
And it is. This is a grim and a savage film. It is difficult to watch at times, so we want to say as early as possible in this sequence that it is also, in our opinion, a masterpiece of film art.
And how true is the film to history of that time?
Well, that's always a vexed question, isn't it? Although there are active disagreements between Chinese and Japanese historians, the consensus, I believe, is that the film is a more or less true version of events.
The massacre took place over a 6-week period following the Japanese capture of Nanjing, which was the then capital of the Republic of China. During this period, hundreds of thousands of Chinese civilians and disarmed soldiers were murdered, and anywhere from 20,000 to 80,000 women were raped by soldiers of the Imperial Japanese Army. Although the battle for Nanjing was fierce, its fall was inevitable since Chiang Kai-shek had withdrawn his elite troops into the interior, hoping to lure the Japanese army into a prolonged war of attrition.
The only international authority left in the city was a committee of resident Westerners headed by a German businessman named John Rabe, or Rabe, I suppose, who plays a substantial part in the film. By the way, there is a German film about him and about the Nanjing massacre called John Rabe. These foreigners and some Chinese doctors and nurses set up a safety zone in the western quarter of the city where they tried to care for civilian victims, at least until Rabe was ordered back to Berlin.
The whole period is often referred to in these events as the rape of Nanjing, and rape is often used just as a metaphor for destruction, devastation, but in the case of Nanjing, rape was a literal fact.
Yes, quite literal. In the film, the safety zone is forcibly entered at various times by bands of Japanese soldiers intent on raping female refugees.
The rape of women was ongoing and brutal. A Western clergyman wrote in his diary for December 1937, "Never have I heard or read such brutality. We estimate at least 1,000 cases a night and many by day. In case of resistance or anything that seems like disapproval, there is a bayonet stab or a bullet. Women are carried off every morning, afternoon, and evening. The whole Japanese army seems to be free to go and come as it pleases and to do whatever it pleases."
Not only were thousands of women kidnapped and forcibly raped in comfort zones that were set up for the entertainment of the occupying army, but also after the fighting stopped, the comfort zones stayed. There were, Marty will tell you about that. But Lou selects a dozen or so individuals and lets us see into their lives, men and women, Japanese, Chinese, European, and American. And it's their small betrayals and sacrifices, brutalities, and kindnesses that make up a plot within the larger story arc of the war.
Yes, this is a shameful chapter of Japanese history, the story of the Chinese and Korean comfort women for the sexual relief of soldiers. Around 200,000 women are estimated to have been involved throughout the war zone.
You spoke, Martha, about how we've known so little about this, and our focus has been elsewhere in Europe when we think of World War II. But why have we known so little?
Well, almost as notorious as the massacre itself was the cover-up. Until very recently, this event was kept from public notice, largely because of disputes between Chinese and Japanese historians, but also because Mao Zedong followed a policy of not publicizing it.
And in addition, most of the Japanese military records on the killings were deliberately destroyed or kept secret shortly after the surrender of Japan. And Japan still denies that any but justified military deaths occurred. No prosecutions took place under the American military occupation because the pact between General MacArthur and Hirohito stipulated that the emperor and all the members of his imperial family were to be granted immunity.
Now, more than 70 years later, the story of Nanjing has begun to reemerge in fiction and nonfiction books and films, notably Iris Chang's best-selling Rape of Nanking. Iris Chang killed herself in 2004, but there was a TV movie about her and about the book made in 2007.
That was shown in Vancouver earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, from what you're saying, this is clearly, it's not a documentary. It's not a documentary-style film. It has a fictionalized account. So who are some of the characters in this film?
Well, the human center of the film is a Japanese soldier, Masao Kadokawa, more and more deeply affected by the inhumanity he witnesses and the inhumanity he commits.
Yes, some of the stories are mawkish and sentimental, but they help to leaven the weight of horror. Among them, there's a Chinese resistance fighter who has an affectionate relationship for his child soldier assistant. And there's a young woman who won't have her hair cut in spite of the threat of the comfort stations, because after the war is over, she will need her hair to make a living as a prostitute on the streets.
Lou's camera picks out characters with whom we can momentarily identify, but they are soon murdered, and the narrative focus passes on to others.
Now, you began saying this is a masterpiece. I'd like you to tell us a bit more why you say that.
Well, I was particularly struck by City of Life and Death as a piece of cinematic art. Although there is relatively little dialogue, Lou's action is always clear. The soundtrack carries music, some of it banal, but much of it exciting, particularly the percussion. There's a thrilling interlude when the Japanese soldiers celebrate their capture of the city, and stripped to the waist, they perform an amazing war dance, accompanied by a huge drum carried on a gun carriage and beaten in a complex polyrhythm by standing men on each side.
But I think mainly it's the photography. The photography is arresting, stunning, deep and clear. And this includes the mass scenes. In this film, the arrangement of vast crowds that characterizes Chinese historical epics is applied to the more measured spaces of modern warfare, and that includes vast fields of corpses. And then black and white really helps. The film has a retro look to it, as we've said, evoking classical photography and early Soviet filmmaking.
It really made me appreciate how much we lose with Technicolor, how much more subtle black and white can be.
Would you say there's some political lesson we can take from this film?
Well, given the long suppression of this event, largely for political reasons, but also perhaps because the West has chosen to have only one Holocaust, the film itself is a political statement. Also, by refusing to turn the Japanese into monsters, Liu insists that their savagery was all too human, and that there was a heavy price paid by soldiers ordered to, quote, kill all, loot all, and burn all. Watching it, you can't believe for one moment that war is anything other than human madness at its crudest level.
Yes, I think it's a strongly anti-war film, but it also conveys a vivid picture of totally militarized society in which men are soldiers and women are receptacles.
Sounds extremely powerful, extremely difficult to watch, and yet your recommendation is go see it.
Definitely worthwhile.
Don't miss it.
It's art. It's uplifting art. Yes.
Thank you very much. I'll wrestle with that paradox in my mind. Thank you. I've been speaking with film critics Martha and Marty Roth, and the film they've been discussing is City of Life and Death. It's showing again tonight, and it'll be showing all next week at the Vancouver International Film Center, which is on Seymour Street.